Great. Hi, everybody. Sorry about those technical difficulties. I think we've gotten them resolved. So we're going to go ahead and get started. Welcome to the GIGU Steering Committee conference call. We're going to be discussing the comments received on the measures. This is Suzanne Cabrera, the project manager. With me on the phone are Reva Winkler and Evan Williamson, the rest of the project team. And now I'd like to go ahead and just call roll so we know which committee members are on the phone. Andy Baskin.
Here.
Great. Chris Sagel. Operator, can you make sure that all the lines are open so that folks can speak? All right, Chris Sagel. Nan, are all the lines open?
Can you hear me?
Okay, yep, now we can hear you.
Okay.
All right, Lily on the board now?
I'm here.
All right, Saheed Butt?
Present.
Great. Robert Ellis?
Here.
Nancy Fowler?
Here.
Edward Gill? Johannes Koch?
Here.
Jennifer Lightdale?
Here.
Richard Luckmeyer?
Here.
Elaine Markland? John Morton? Ann Pelletier Cameron? Stuart Reynolds?
Here.
Phil Schoenfeld? All right, great. And for the developers, do we have AMA PCPI on the line? Do we have Active Health on the line?
Yes, she's fine here.
ARC? I think they're going to be joining us later, actually. And NCQA?
Yes, this is NCQA.
Great. Thanks, everybody, for joining us this afternoon. Just a couple of housekeeping things. All lines are open on this call, so please put your phone on mute when you're not speaking, and please don't put us on hold as usual, because we'll get your hold music. So with that said, I'm going to turn the call over to Chris and Andy, our co-chairs, to begin the discussion. Chris and Andy, are you?
Yeah, I'm here, and I presume Chris is, I guess I want to know which measures we're going to start with so I know whether Chris or I is going to start the conversation.
Okay, sure. We are going to start with measures 658 and 659.
Okay, so this is Andy. This is up my alley then, so I think I'll do the GI ones except for the hepatitis A measure.
Okay.
The vaccine measure. So the comments on 658 and 659 are kind of lumped together. They're similar comments on both. If you had perused the comment sheet, I think they fall into a couple of baskets. One is the issue of the potential for quote-unquote gaming, which is essentially the idea that that lack of history for prior colonoscopies essentially can move someone out of the game here, at least for the forward-thinking one, which is the one that's the colonoscopies every 10 years after a normal colonoscopy, the recommendation, the idea that it's really not looking back at the performance of that particular colonoscopy, whether it was premature, is essentially lumped into this kind of gaming idea, or at least less value. The other issue that's brought up by some of the comments is the exclusions and the ability to exclude based on more specifically medical reasons. I don't think there was much concern about the other ones. And that's once again an opportunity to potentially game, I guess, is a tough word, but it's a word that's used by some of the commenters. Now, on the other hand, there were several commenters who commented that the measures were great the way they were and were very happy with them. So I don't know whether anyone now wants to discuss these types of comments, of the ones of concern here. I think they do reflect some of the same things we talked about in our meetings, And I'm not so sure that that anything new came out of the developer's responses. At least I didn't think so, not that there needed to be, but that we already identified these as inadequacies in the measures. But as is mentioned in somebody's comment somewhere, you know, don't let perfect get in the way here, and that our decision was based on the fact that these were good measures as is, the way they were presented. They could be better. And we have provided that feedback to the developers for the next round of these measures, but that, you know, we had to make a decision on the measures as is, as are they good enough to endorse, and which is what our prior decision was. So any comments beyond that from the group or regarding these two measures, 658 or 659? Or did I get it right?
Yes. Yep, we'll be returning to these measures at the end of the call to discuss the e-specs, but we're going to go over the comments first.
Yeah. Anyone want to make any comment on the comments? Okay, well, as I said, I don't think there was any new ground in what was presented in the comments, so I can appreciate if there are no additional comments to be made.
All right.
Go ahead. I was going to say, what's the next? The hepatitis A one, I think, is Chris is going to do that because I have a conflict here.
Yes. We're going to move on to 635, chronic liver disease.
Okay. So I guess this is the one. There was a question about whether this is a national level measure or not.
Yes.
And that's one of the comments that Dan Hiroff is especially endorsing measures that don't measure quality at the national level because there's no comparator group and no one holds accountable. And my reading of it, of this measure, was that it could be used at the plan level, was being used at the plan level, and we specifically asked whether it could be exported to other settings outside of a provider that had an active health contract. So I'm assuming that it could be used easily at a more granular level than the national level. So it's like an important concern if it could only be used as a national level measure. I think it's satisfying that it could be used in a different context. Any other comments?
Chris, this is Reva from NQF. I'd just like to clarify a bit. In terms of the endorsement that NQF grants, part of the specification is the data level that is indicated. And so if indeed this measure is only indicated at a national level, then even though it may be used elsewhere, the endorsement does not extend to that, which is why we've got an issue here. Frankly, NQF does not have any other measures that are endorsed solely at the national level. That is really in the national level of analysis is really a roll-up of state or regional population level measures. And as you indicated, this measure has clearly been used at the health plan level, and was the testing information that was provided to us was that of two health plans and an employer group. And so I think that at this point, for NQF to endorse it as a national level doesn't really serve anyone's particular purpose. If the developers were inclined to indicate that it is also a health plan level, that would be included in the endorsement, and then the committee can make their final recommendation on that.
Okay. So I think that the developer, Active Health, is on the line. Can they make that amendment to their measure that can be used at the health plan level too?
This is Bonnie here. Can you hear me?
Yes.
That's fine with Active Health.
Okay, so assuming that Active Health is able to make that amendment, can I ask if the committee has any objections then with that basis? So not hearing any objections, I think it's a good point that we clarified and we can move on.
Chris, I have a point of clarification on this measure from the developer's one of the developer's responses.
Okay.
So this was in response to Matt Austin's question from the Armstrong Institute. Mm-hmm. And in the response, the developer states that because this is an e-measure, and I wanted some clarification on that, I didn't realize that this was an e-measure in the terms how we define e-measures.
Can I ask the person from Active Health, is it specified as an e-measure?
Sure. This is Dr. Beer from Active Health. We use the e-measure verbiage sort of on a technical basis because all of our data sources are electronic. So whether we're getting even feedback and survey data, it is entered electronically into numerator and denominator information. And all of our measures the data for all of our measures are run through an electronic rules engine.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding of e-measure definition is that would only, what you just described would only qualify for it to be sourcing its data from electronic sources. But does it have an HQMF version of the logic, and does it have value sets defined which are following the e-measures framework?
I'm sorry, what was the question?
My question is that e-measures have a very specific definition and constraint as to what the framework should be in terms of how the logic gets specified and how the value sets get developed. Does this measure follow all those attributes?
Yes, it does.
Zahid, this is Ruta. I don't believe this measure was submitted in HQMF format.
So would you consider it an e-measure then, Reva?
NQF has defined e-measures as needing to be submitted in HQMF. So if it's not, then I would say no. It's not technically what we consider an e-measure.
That would be my reading of it also.
Okay. My apologies. I didn't understand that there was an NQF definition specifically that you were referring to.
Okay.
So
I think when you say something is an e-measure, it has a lot of things that it needs to conform to before you can call something an e-measure.
Right. So is there a quest to change that verbiage?
I would suggest that in order to avoid confusion, that this be rephrased as a measure that uses data sources that are electronic. I think that's as far as it can go, as far as I can see.
Okay.
Okay. If the steering committee would like us to reword our response to the comment, then that we're open to that.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Are there any other concerns about that?
I think the biggest concern that was voiced, I think, was something which was discussed also, that prior immunity, people feel that it would be unnecessary vaccination of folks who may be immune already,
mm-hmm.
if they want to get high scores on this measure, since it's not addressing that particular aspect.
If I could be allowed to comment to that,
sure.
We used to have prior immunity testing as part of the numerator for this measure, because immunity testing to the hepatitis A antibody comes across as either a positive or negative result, not as a numerical value. Labs tests that do not come across as a numerical value, they're difficult to ingest in any sort of meaningful way. So whereas in the past we allowed for immunity testing alone to act as a surrogate for the numerator, we were asked by the NQF to remove that because of the inability to differentiate a positive or negative test.
I think the intent of the comment is to see if there is a way to exclude it from the denominator in some sense, because they don't require immunization.
Agreed.
If there's a positive.
Agreed. And the same difficulty comes whether you include it in as an exclusion or as a numerator inclusion. It's merely a sort of a difficulty with the type of data it is. We do allow for survey feedback and patient feedback, both from providers or patients saying that they are immune.
Okay. So we've gone over this a little bit as a group. Any other comments about this issue with the prior immunization status or exposure status? Okay. Zahid, are you satisfied in terms of your concern?
I mean, I think it is still a concern. I'm still having a little trouble because the rationale that was given why a yes-no couldn't be accommodated is because it's an e-measure, and if it's not an e-measure, why can't that response be accommodated, a positive-negative response?
It's merely the way the data is codified. There are no e-measures that can ingest, as far as my knowledge, that can ingest a positive or negative result from a loinc value.
Right, but this is not an e-measure, though. We just determined that, didn't we?
Why we allow for feedback. We allow for survey data as well.
So it's a limitation basically because there's no way to incorporate yes or no answers in your algorithm.
Reactive or non-reactive, yeah.
It's a loin code. It doesn't come across as a numerical value.
I see. So for that part of it, you're using codified data.
That's right.
Okay.
And that's why we allow for the feedback to for any data gap.
Right. And the issue is that the value is not available from prior status.
That's right. That's right. It only comes across as a word, positive or negative.
Mm-hmm. Right.
For non-reactive.
So I think that if I recall from previous conversation, you had presented some, or maybe I'm mistaken, but maybe you can clarify that what is your sense of what percentage of people will have prior immunity and will get revaccinated if somebody wants to get their score up? Or if they don't do that, then they would get a lower score inappropriately.
Well, we would have to go back and reanalyze the data with this new question that you're asking. It would require a reanalysis of some of the test data that we've done already.
Because I think that's really what goes to the heart of this question that the person who commented wanted to know. Because they're concerned that there will be excessive overuse of the vaccination for people who don't even need it, or that people who will appropriately not get vaccinated will be dinged.
I understand the concerns and can appreciate them. I hope that the steering committee can also appreciate that this measure, along with our last measure, was under review for over a year, and we're getting these comments in sort of the 11th hour. It would be difficult now to go back and rerun all of the data and retest at this point. I'm not saying that we couldn't do it for future reviews, but at this time, considering that it's been under review for over a year, we've been working on it for over a year, it would be difficult to do.
Is there any kind of general sense in the population literature about what the prevalence is of people that have had hepatitis?
My guess is it's very population dependent. Some populations may have a very high incidence, others might not. I think if you went to certain areas where hepatitis A is more common and endemic, you could probably have very high incidences. But in many other populations, you probably wouldn't have as high an incidence. So, it's okay. I think as long as we can maybe have the developer later on perhaps look at that issue and see if I don't know the process, Reva. Is it something which it could get endorsed now and they could come back and do an update on it? Is that something that can be done?
At this point, we need the steering committee to, look at the information, look at the comments, and make a decision. You have recommended this measure. The question is, all of these issues that have been raised, does that make you want to change your recommendation at this point in time?
I personally don't think that it reaches the threshold of changing it for me.
Okay. Does anyone else, does it change their minds, this comment? All right. So I guess we can just say that we understand and agree with the commenter and that the developer is aware of this limitation. And I guess we've heard some expression that they would be able to look at it in terms of feedback data over the next year. Is that what I understood correctly?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. All right. Well, if that's the case, then we should just note that and move on, I think. So the next one, is that the urinary incontinence one?
Yes.
So this is measure 98, the NCQA measure about assessment, characterization, and plan of care for incontinence. So the physician who was in charge of this review couldn't come today after Markland, but I can summarize what the comments were in general about this. The biggest concerns, I think, were on this is kind of a check-the-box process of care measure with an unclear relationship to outcomes of care, and there were some concerns that it only measured women age 65 and older, and concerns that it was pretty topped out and that, most of the people that report on it in PQRS are getting topped out in terms of their performance on it. So Dr. Markland has some comments about that, which I can inform the group of. Basically, she does agree with some of them. Comment she has is that although it does apply to a specific population of women over 65, that this is where you see a lot of the burden of illness, and it's appropriate to measure it in them. And regarding the PQRS concern, she feels that they might be a solid sort of group of people that are reporting, and that as PQRS is more widely implemented, we'll find gaps, which I think is a reasonable thing to assume. And in terms of the check-the-box measure, I do think that if you are attesting to an evaluation and treatment plan for somebody with incontinence, that is probably going to be linked to an outcome that matters to them. So I think that if you just talk about assessing it in general, it could be a check-the-box thing, but I think if you link it to a treatment plan as part of the measure, that does go towards a relationship to an outcome measure patients would care about. Those are my thoughts about that. Does the group have any other comments about that?
Yeah, this is Nancy, and I do have a concern also and have had a concern. I think there's a huge qualitative piece that's missing. I mean, you can say treatment, but was the treatment that was given to the patient appropriate for what the patient's problem was? And I just think that that's not evident in the tool.
Yeah, well, it certainly doesn't. You don't know anything about appropriateness, that's for sure. I guess
you could think you were doing well because you gave the person treatment, but if you had a patient with urgent incontinence and you gave them pelvic muscle exercises, you haven't really done anything to help them, and you've in fact actually maybe made it worse.
Yeah, that's true. My sense is what motivated the measure was the fact that this is under-recognized as a problem by women, that they think of it as a component of normal aging. And that having the discussion and formulating a plan represents a big evolution in the quality of care for them. So I would agree that you're heading towards the idea of what's appropriate, what's going to help the person, what are the outcomes indeed that matter. I'm okay with this being a first step there. I don't know if anyone else has got a concern at that level.
Hi, Chris, it's Ann Cameron. I agree with you. I mean, this is really a first step question. Were patients assessed and given a treatment plan? Yes, the treatment plan might not be correct, but usually the first step in treating incontinence, whether it be a medication or pelvic floor physical therapy, none of those things are harmful, and they get someone actually identified as having incontinence. So I like the measure the way it is.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anyone else? Uh, Nancy, does your concern rise to the level where you want to reconsider the measure as going forward?
It would have, but I think if Ann supports it as a urologist, I would back her on that.
Okay.
And I agree with her. I totally agree that the discussion is the beginning. But if you ask the patient, was it discussed? I'm not sure that the patient all the time is able to adequately answer that. Just, maybe they can. I just don't know.
Okay.
But no, I would support Anna.
Okay. All right. Well, then the next one is GI. Anne, do you want to take care of that one? 2065.
You bet. So
Absolutely.
206. Oops.
Andy,
go ahead,
sorry, let me interrupt. Well, we just need to check and see if we've got Patrick Romano on the line yet. He thought he might not be able to join until 5. Patrick, are you there? All right. It's, what we will have to do is jump ahead to the remaining issues, and then we can come back to this at the as we get to 5 o'clock.
Yep.
So we'll jump forward to the comments on measures not recommended, which was 622.
Oh. I read the comments. I don't remember any comments on 622. I'm sorry. What did I miss? I went down the entire list and read them all. Were there specific comments on 622 that I didn't see?
I'm
sorry.
Yep.
Oh. So that puts me on the spot.
Well, basically, we had one comment on the measure that raised some concerns about the measure, and the NQF staff have proposed a draft response in the memo. We just want to make sure that response is okay with the committee, and or if the committee has anything they'd like to add.
Yeah, and I apologize because while I see this comment, I'm not supposed to be discussing this measure either because of a conflict, so I apologize.
So this is Zahid. I think that the concern as I read it was more that perhaps the committee didn't feel later on that this was an important enough measure because of the small population. As I recall, that was not the main concern that we had. It was the specification itself identified the numerator in ways that we thought would be highly inaccurate in getting basically this measure really gets to if you have alarm symptoms, whether you had an endoscopy done or not, sort of the core of the issue. But I believe that the numerator had things like, you qualified even if you had a gastric emptying study done and gastrectomy done and things like that. So there were lots of assumptions built into the specification, which I believe were part of the problem with this measure.
I think that, this is Suzanne, that sounds correct. I mean, is there, basically we just wanted to get a response out to this commenter and, the committee has any edits to the draft response in the memo, you can let us know now or you can let us know in the next day or so.
Yeah, I didn't actually read the draft response in detail, but I did read the comment, and it looks like the comment assumes that because it was a small population, the committee felt in stage one that it was important, but that in stage two it changed its mind. But I don't think that was the case.
Yes, that's correct. In our draft response, we just suggested that, the measure needed additional work. It was not tested adequately, and the specifications were not precisely specified.
Right.
And it didn't pass the scientific acceptability criteria, but we did encourage the developer to bring it back in the future.
Right, right.
Okay. We do occasionally put some draft responses in the memo, so if you folks have any changes you want to make, just let us know in the next day or two before we finalize those. think the next area for discussion was the measure gaps and areas for future measure development. There were a number of suggestions for that, and basically what we do with those is we just go ahead and add those to the report unless anybody has any concerns with those recommendations, you know, and we can also take any additional suggestions that you may have thought of since we last asked you.
So I this is Zahid again. I think that one of the measures that was mentioned was the steroid sparing use of steroid sparing drugs in IBD, and I think that's an important aspect to measure, and I think it had the same issue in terms of the specifications, et cetera. So I think, mm-hmm. again, we agree that it's an important measure to report, but I think it needs more work.
Yes, actually, that measure was not submitted in stage two. It had
right. I think one of the commentators assumed that somehow we sort of didn't think. It implied that perhaps the committee didn't feel it was important.
Yeah, we can clarify that response in the responses to the comments. We'll just let that commenter know it was not submitted, but we can do it in the future.
Yeah, I would say that clarifying that would be good.
Okay. And
so, so while we're waiting for the chief from AHRQ, what should we go to the e-measure spec part, or do we have another part that we have to do?
No, I think you've actually covered, unless there are any committee members have any other comments they wanted to address that didn't come up yet other than the ARC comments, then we can jump ahead to the e-measure discussion and then come back to the ARC measure at the end of the call.
Right, and I think we already noted that the measure, the colonoscopy index is not going to require any more discussion at this level. It's going to be at the CSEC level, right? So we can tie that off?
That's correct.
Okay,
yep.
Just want to make sure of that.
This is Phil Schoenfeld. I'm sorry, because I missed the first 10 minutes. What's going on with this measure at the CSEC level?
There was just a comment noted that while we got public comment, there's no more discussion at the steering committee level. Apparently, CSAC has chosen, because they've gotten some feedback as well, to discuss the issue. That doesn't necessarily mean, I don't know what that will entail, but that's a decision that's outside of this committee.
What is CSAC?
CSAC is the committee that this group reports to, the Consensus Standards Approval Committee, which is the final endorser of the steering committee's recommendations before it goes to the board of directors. So it's the multi-representation type of committee that does the endorsements, and then they're finally approved or not by the board of directors. So it's a level above steering committee.
Is there anybody in the steering committee who's going to participate in those discussions to express the views of the committee?
Yes. Well, I believe the co-chairs will. I certainly will because I happen to sit on the CSAC, but I would presume that both of us will be invited to that particular CSAC meeting to discuss it.
Okay. Is it possible that I might be able to participate by teleconference just for that portion of the discussion?
I don't have the answer to that, but we can ask NQF offline about that.
Yeah, no, this is Reva. Those CSAC meetings are public meetings, and we'll be happy to let you know when it happens and when you can call in and what the agenda is.
Yeah, I forgot about that. They're certainly public. The question is whether he has to be part of the public comment or whether he can actually participate in the regular conversation, I think, is really what he's asking.
Well, you know.
And I don't know the answer to that, so.
Yeah. Determined by the co-chairs.
Okay, I'll let you guys figure that part out. 0658 and 0659. Again, when I came onto the call, we'd already moved on to other stuff. Any issues with those two?
It was really a rehash of the, essentially things that we had already commented on previously. There was no new ground here, and this committee acknowledged that, and no changes are contemplated in our decisions as of the comments that we made today.
Okay.
It was just we acknowledged the deficiencies of those measures, but that we let them, we okayed them because they're better than what's not there, and that the developers know that there's some improvements that need to be made the next time around, kind of where we left it.
Okay. Can I make one other comment, though, on the colonoscopy quality index, just real briefly?
I actually prefer not. This has been something that's been opened up so many times, it really should not come back to this committee for another discussion. But, Phil, that opportunity will occur at the CSAC level. It won't do any good to comment at this level. It really won't.
I
really don't want to open it up here. It's not. It's not. It gets. It's gotten.
Okay,
it's
that's
full,
fine.
Full
yeah,
here many times.
Fine. That's fine. You can all breathe a sigh of relief. I'm not saying anything.
but I'm not discouraging you from making comments at the appropriate venue. It's just this is not the venue. The CSAC would be the venue.
So we'll follow up with the whole committee with the information on the CSAC call and that when that's going to be discussed. We'll get that out to you pretty soon. We just have to finalize that.
Okay, e-measures.
All righty.
Yeah, where are we going with the I'm not sure where to take us with the e-measures other than it's the two endoscopy measures, which are the e-measures that we're to discuss.
Yeah. This is Rita. If you recall, the steering committee left it that you wanted to see a crosswalk of the specifications from the e-measure to the original measure. You did recommend the original measure, but you had sort of held a recommendation on the e-specs until you could look at the crosswalk. The measure developers have provided the crosswalk. It is attached to your memo with the details. And I know, Zahid, this was something you were specifically looking at. Have you had a chance to review it?
Yes, Riva, I have. And I must compliment the developer for doing a good job with the crosswalk. It is well done, and it is addressing some of the issues, including a wrong code in the original measure, which they have corrected. So I think that it is much easier to follow now what it is, and they have a additional document that describes the changes they have made. I do have one quick question. If I know that the MAP CPI is on the call, that in 659, where they describe the measure, sort of describes that it has to be an adenoma polyp to get into the previous colonoscopy, should have had adenomatous polyp. But in the value sets for the denominator, there are value sets that are just plain old benign polyps without stating that they are adenoma polyps. Does that mean that those nonspecific codes would still qualify for a denominator?
Hi, Dr. Butt. This is Anu Gupta at the AMA PCPI. Which are you referring to, the colonic polyps value set, the individual codes?
Yes. Yes, yes. The individual codes that are in there in the value set detail?
Yes, I think the denominator.
There are codes just for, it says adenoma, it says polyp, colon polyps, basically. So I'm just wondering how is that used, if it's, because the only place the colon polyp code gets in here is in the denominator of the previous colonoscopy, right? The previous colonoscopy should have had an adenomatous polyp by definition, and I'm just not clear how that code that is not specific for adenomatous polyp but just for general colon polyps is going to get used.
Yeah, Zahi, this is Kendra Hanley. I could jump in. Part of that is the limitation of the ICD-9 and the ICD-10 coding. So we did include, we actually chose to not include ICD-9 in this.
Uh-huh.
We included ICD-10 and SNOMED. And
right.
The ICD-10 that are included are, you know, how the adenomatous would be coded, although in looking at them a little bit closer right now, I see that they are not necessarily specific, although they would
yes.
be appropriate codes to code an adenomatous polyp.
Right, right. But my concern would be that those nonspecific codes would potentially qualify a case in the denominator, which would be contrary to the definition, essentially.
Right. So this is where we get a little stuck between the recommendations for what terminologies we should use for what data types and the information that can actually be captured in that terminology.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we, you know, would certainly consider just taking out the ICD-10 in addition to the ICD-9, which we already did.
Yeah, the non-specific ones, I would recommend you take another look, but I think other than that, it looks fine. Everything looks fine to me.
Okay.
Does anyone on the committee have additional concerns? I certainly would like to have some put my thanks into Zahid for clarifying this all for us. I know in the last meeting you made it so that I understood exactly what the concerns were, and I appreciate the fact that to the best of the ability of the coding, the limitations of the coding, that the concerns were addressed. And thank you again for that review, Zahid. It's very, very helpful to all of us.
Thank you.
Then there's no additional comments. Now, we come to a conclusion yet on the e-measures, or are we going to have to vote at some point?
You do need to come to a conclusion on whether to recommend those e-specifications as an additional part of the measure endorsement.
And are we doing that on this call, or are we doing that on a survey after the call, or how is that happening?
If you can do it on the call, that would be grand.
Well, there's no reason why not. If anyone we'll call for a yays and nays. But if anyone feels that they cannot give a yay or a nay because they need some time, then certainly say that as well, and we'll let your vote come in later, I presume, in a reasonable period of time. So I'm going to
Andy, we've got a electronic vote set up, so we can jump ahead to that slide.
Oh, okay.
Anyone
and are we doing both measures at the same time?
Yes.
Okay. Do we know how many voting members we have today?
I believe we have 12.
Okay. Well, I see 8.
Andy,
is there
I'm not on the computer anymore, but my vote is yes.
Thank you, Chris. So that we have 9, that would be 10.
Okay, and I'm getting confirmation that we have 11 people who can vote. So
okay, so we have one missing. Is there someone
difficulty
voting, or is there one person that feels they cannot vote today for some reason or another?
Or is there anybody who isn't
in
the
computer?
There's
10. There's 10. So Chris would be 11. So now we have them all. Thank you, everybody.
I went to the restroom. Sorry about that.
No, it's quite all right. Appreciate it.
All right, great.
Do you have to read that into the minutes, 11 yeses and 0 noes?
Yes, thank you.
I guess you just did. You're welcome.
So those e-measure specifications are now recommended, as well as the regular measure specs. So I think at this time we're going to need to return to 2065. Is there anybody who's representing that measure on the phone yet?
This is Jeff Gebert from the RQI support line. I can represent HRQ.
Okay, great.
Great. So let's open that one up. So there were several comments here, and I think the comments really had two types of comments. One was a more technical reliability testing comment, of which I believe there is a response from ARC, which even I may ask for a little bit of explanation of how they got that 20-some percent. I'm trying to figure that out myself after having looked at it. We'll do that in a second. And I, presumably others have the same questions I have, just a helpful explanation. But the other was I think they're related issues, but this issue of using the principal diagnosis only versus principal diagnosis plus either a secondary or further down secondary diagnosis, and the fact that there are small numbers, which probably is partially a result of using only the principal diagnosis, and there are concerns that that the way people code hospital charts is that while I understand the developers noted that you get a more homogeneous sample by using principal diagnosis only, the question is it so limiting that you get such a homogeneous sample that you actually don't get a true representation, which is what I'm reading between the lines of the commenters, in that it's not truly a representation of the majority of GI bleeds, just a subset of them, and such a subset that it's not really representative of what's really going on out there. So,
Eddie, this is Rahid. I think that this last comment that you just made, I think you really have to probably stick with the principal diagnosis for GI bleeding, because this is an outcome measure that is measuring mortality of GI bleeding. And if the secondaries are included, then it really would not be truly representative of mortality related to GI bleeding. I mean, there are people who were even questioning whether the mortality is directly tied to the GI bleeding. They want to get down to that level of specificity, but I think the closest you can get to the specificity in terms of someone coming in with a major GI hemorrhage and what is their mortality, I think you really have to limit yourself to the principal diagnosis. That's kind of how...
Yeah, and I understand that point. I guess the point I was making at there are those that would say that all GI bleeding is due to something. Other words, is there truly ever a primary GI bleed? And the answer is no, because GI bleed is a sign symptom, I guess, but there has to be an underlying cause. And is the underlying cause going to be the principal diagnosis, which is often the case, and is often the case based on DRG reimbursement, I might add, as to whether that's a better diagnosis to use, and therefore are you really siphoning off these cases because it's actually more practical, it's actually beneficial for a hospital to use the cause of the GI bleed instead of calling it GI bleed when in fact they were admitted for GI bleeding, yet in reality if the underlying diagnosis is whatever, whatever reason is causing the bleeding, you know what I mean? They'll use that as a primary diagnosis. So in doing that, yeah, you get this homogeneous population, but is it really meaningful?
No, I see exactly your concern, but the contrary argument is that does it really matter if GI bleeding is number 10 on the list of diagnoses and the patient came in with AMI or CHF and died? So would you then attribute that to GI bleeding?
That's a tough question. You come in with GI bleeding and it actually caused you to have CHF.
Right.
Do you
but
have
then
CHF
at least,
or do you
at
have
least
GI
you
bleed?
Would at least you would be the principal reason for why you came in would be GI bleeding. But if you flip it around, and I agree with what you just said, that many times the coding might be more specific than GI bleeding. But if they follow the coding convention and someone is admitted with GI bleeding, often the diagnosis is not known at that point. So the principal diagnosis really should be GI bleeding, and then secondary could be peptic ulcer disease, esophageal varices, or whatever else.
This, I believe
it's not a discharge diagnosis. This is an admitting, this is an admitting diagnosis. So that's why oftentimes can't even figure it out.
I think the discharge diagnosis, the definition of principal diagnosis is that it is the diagnosis that led to the admission after all the, evaluation has been complete. So it's a discharge diagnosis, really, but it takes into account what the patient came in for. It is the principal reason why the patient came in for admission. That's the official definition of a principal discharge diagnosis. Hmm.
No, I understand that, but if the patient came in with congestive heart failure, and as it turns out, the congestive heart failure was caused by a hemoglobin of 3 from GI bleeding, what's the discharge diagnosis?
It would be congestive heart failure if they came in with congestive heart failure.
Yeah, but the cause of it was high output congestive heart failure from anemia from GI bleed. GI bleed was
sure, no, I understand. I understand.
But that's what happens, though, in the coding, and that's why I... especially if someone's going to be measured on the mortality of GI bleeding, then they're just not going to code people as GI bleeding when they die. They're going to use the other diagnosis when they have a choice. And I think that's the issue that the commenters are bringing up. And I frankly, having been around the way hospitals code, and I'm not saying that in a derogatory sense, I mean, they're doing what they're doing. They're coding to maximize, the reimbursement for the care that they did provide. That's how it works. Well, let me ask the developer, I'm sorry, I've forgotten your name already. I'm terrible with that. If you can comment first on the reliability specs that I know you, that there was an added note about to us is just what your response to that, the comments were.
Sure, and unfortunately, I think Patrick is really going to have to address this second issue on the coding. But on the reliability, the comment was about the overall reliability of the GI hemorrhage measure, and our comment is really tied to the fact that the reliability metric is not sort of an overall characteristic attribute of the measure, but it's really an attribute of the measure when it's applied to a particular data set. And it's incorporated into the performance score calculations. The thing that we focus on is, how much useful information is there after this reliability adjustment has been taken into account. And so the preventability table that was included in the response is just an attempt to demonstrate how much useful information remains in the measure even after the reliability has been accounted for. It just shows that if, all hospitals were to perform at kind of the benchmark level of care based on the distribution that's remaining in the performance scores after the reliability is taken into account, there actually is quite a bit of variability remaining. Which suggests, the potentially a preventability rate of about 20-some percent. So it's basically just a demonstration of the fact that there's a considerable body of useful information, even after accounting for the reliability of the measure, the relatively small sample sizes.
Okay, I appreciate that. Anybody on the committee have any follow-up question regarding that, or are people okay with that explanation or response?
Yeah, this is Ahid. I have a question. Is this using the risk-adjusted rates, or is it non-adjusted rates?
It's using the risk-adjusted rates.
Okay. So taking risk adjustment reliability into account, there's still a 20% potential variation of a preventability type.
Right.
Okay. Thank
exactly.
you.
Okay, well, hearing no other comments, thank you very much. And so I don't know how we're going to get to the other part of this then, other than our own internal discussion here. And I'm not so sure that there's much more to be said about it, but does anybody else have any comments regarding this principal diagnosis issue?
Hi, it's Liliana Borghiano. I just wanted to make one comment.
Yes, please.
Essentially, we're going back to the discussion we had at the very beginning. When you're measuring death, it's hard to cheat on that number, but the question is, will the system be cheated by simply coding, as you said, in a different way. And I don't think that NQF can, no matter how good a measure we come up with, you know, if the hospital wants to cheat on coding to not report a death, they will find a way to cheat on coding to not report a death. But by the same token, I think that the measure in itself makes sense. And yes, there are patients that come in with massive GI hemorrhage, and when you measure the performance of all the services that are involved in the care of that patient, there is a variability in care from hospitals to hospitals based on volume, based on the resources that are available, and it's important to measure.
Yeah, no, I agree, but the question is how much of the variability is related to differences in care and how much of the variability is related to differences in coding, in which case then the actual, there could be unintended consequences of this measure, to be honest with you. It rewards good coders.
Oh, yeah, that's an imponderable.
Yeah. To me, that's a major concern, especially since it is such a not frequent occurring event to die from a GI hemorrhage in a relative to other diagnoses in hospitals and other mortality causes. So that, you know, one or two cases make a big difference in your result because they are small denominators to start with. I don't know how to resolve this, but it's not just this measure, as it turns out. It's some of the other measures that measure hospitalization rates that have similar issues, as it turns out.
So I think that, I'm sorry, Vivian, go ahead.
No, I just said that was a good point.
So I think that the small numbers issue is a different issue than the coding issue, but I think they do, that small numbers issue is actually one of the problems across the board in quality measurement, especially when you get into provider-specific performance. And so I think that there is that methodology that they allude to in their response, the shrinkage methodology. I don't pretend to understand all of it, but I have seen that used before to try to get around the small numbers issue. Maybe Reva could comment on that, or the ARC folks could comment. But I think they get around that by using their shrinkage methodology.
Any comments regarding that methodology?
Yeah, exactly. The shrinkage methodology is intended to address the small numbers issue, and it's intended to minimize the likelihood of making an invalid inference based on an unreliability-adjusted risk-adjusted rate. So basically what it does is it shrinks the risk-adjusted rate to some shrinkage target, which could be the overall mean, or it could be some regression determined mean based on hospital attributes. In this case, it's just the overall mean. So basically, you know, if your rate is based on a small number of cases, your ultimate performance score will be close to the overall mean. And it has sort of an error minimization rationale statistically.
But at the end of the day, you lose no matter what, you lose some of the ability to differentiate providers. I mean, it essentially becomes wide confidence levels, right? I mean, that's what the result of all that.
Yeah, if you're in a low information context where, you know, you only observe a small number of cases, then that does limit your ability to make performance comparisons. So what we tend to focus on is how much useful information remains, even in a low information context. And it's often the case that even, you know, in a low information context, there's still a lot of useful information remaining, not as much as you might like, but still useful enough for consumers and providers to make informed decisions.
I think my issue with the small numbers is not to say that I understand what you're all saying about how you can utilize small numbers to, there's still some useful information remaining, is my point was how it relates to the coding issue, in that it doesn't take a lot of coding changes from one coding differences in coding strategies from one provider to another when you have small numbers to make a difference. I think that was my connection there, and that's the way the world is. I mean, you know, if your N is low, then aggressive coding is easier to make a difference, move you from one category to another. So I worry about the usefulness of this measure in differentiating providers in the real world, in the practical real world, because the assumption is, with the measures is that you have good codes and that people are all coding the same way.
And that's true for any
to make it work.
Coded measure. That's true.
Yeah.
We're always
reliable. But as I say, that is amplified in a small number situation, in my opinion.
I think you know, our usual response in respect to the principal diagnosis question is the one that was articulated earlier. There's always sort of a sensitivity specificity trade-off with respect to identifying patients. The GI bleed and the approach that is really applied sort of consistently, as you alluded to, sort of applied consistently across all the QIs, is to focus more on the specificity than the sensitivity, and focus on the cases where we have a greater degree of confidence that the conditions associated with GI hemorrhage. But by virtue of that, we're going to miss some cases that are also related to GI hemorrhage, but are where it's identified in the secondary codes.
Right.
Yeah. So it's a trade-off. Absolutely.
Any other comments by anybody regarding this measure? Is there any specific decision we need to come by, or
does anybody on the committee wish to re-vote the measure or not, same as the other? Does this raise any further issues that you make you want to re-vote?
Is there anybody on the committee that would like an opportunity for a re-vote? Or are we... And if not, then obviously the assumption is that we're all okay with the vote that we made, whatever that vote was.
The original vote was to recommend.
I don't hear anyone speaking up, so I think the prior vote is the vote.
Well, I think you have covered everything that came up in the comments, unless anybody wants to raise any other issues that haven't been discussed. If not, we can move forward to the member and public comment period.
Hearing none, I think you can open it up for public comment. And member and public comment. I can't count the members as public as well. Who opens the lines?
Our operator, Nan, you can open up the lines for public comment, please.
Yes, all lines are open.
Thank you.
Andy, this is Tom James.
I'm sorry, I was on mute. Yes, hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Hi. Just a couple of things, and I appreciate all the effort that the committee has put together. Number one is the movement towards ICD-10. And how that's going to impact particularly the e-measures, because I did not see ICD-10 coding put in there specifically. But secondarily, and that gets to the larger issue, as you know, last week in JAMA, Drs. Conway, Clancy, and Fassard put together an article on the direction for measures and made specific comments that we should avoid what they call narrow-focused measures and think more in terms of the national quality strategy. I'm concerned that a lot of the measures discussed today are still very much in that older mode of being narrow-focused. They're important, but it's the context which counts.
Yeah, Yeah, I appreciate that, Tom. I'm going to ask someone to comment about ICD-10 because I believe that NQF already has some process around ICD-10 coding. Interesting about your other comment, but I also saw that article. I think one of the issues is that still people need measures that will help them with quality improvement, and oftentimes the broader measures aren't as specifically helpful for quality improvement, but I think it's been well stated by you and by many that there is a need for some additional measures that are broader and more encompassing type of measures that you speak about. Not necessarily to replace these measures, but potentially in addition to these measures.
Okay, good.
Thanks, Tom. But a comment about ICD-10, because I believe that's something that's in NQF's documents already about the requirements.
Yeah, this is Reva. As of April 1st, we're requiring the both ICD-9 and ICD-10 with the measure submissions. These measures preceded that requirement. So we would anticipate, however, on their next annual update that they will be submitting updates to include ICD-10 coding.
Okay, good. And all the measure developers are going to be using the same GEMS format?
The requirement is that they explain how they did their conversion, and GEMS is certainly an option.
Thank you, Reva. Any other public member comments? Perhaps we'll give it another minute or so if someone wants to speak up, gathering their thoughts.
Andy, I think those who've wanted to speak have spoken.
Yep, sounds that way. So are we officially adjourning the meeting, or is there anything else that needs to be said from NQF?
If there are any questions from any questions from any committee members, no. Suzanne will let you know what the next steps are, but thank you very much for your time. Suzanne?
Yes.
Yep, just to let you know the next steps, we're going to move these measures to NQF member voting. So what we'll do is we'll write up responses to all the comments that don't already have a response, and we'll redline the report that was put out for comment. And when both of those are ready, we will open that for NQF member voting. We're expecting to open that either Friday or Monday, most likely, and I will let the committee and the developers know when that's open. And that lasts for 2 weeks, and once that has closed, we'll let you know the results, and the measures will be brought to CSAC, the Consensus Standards Approval Committee, for their review. And we expect that to happen at their July meeting. I believe that's July 11th and 12th. Is that correct, Evan?
The 10th and 11th.
Oh, sorry, 10th and 11th. So that will, once we have that agenda finalized, I'll let you know when those measures will be discussed. And following CSAC review, the board gives their stamp of approval, and that's the official enforcement date. And then we'll have one more opportunity for people to weigh in, and that's the appeals period, which will open after the board endorsement. So next steps are NQF staff working on the responses and getting everything ready for vote. This pretty much concludes most of the committee's work. We may ask you to weigh in on one of the responses, some of the responses, just to make sure that we've adequately reflected everything. But we don't anticipate, unless something major comes up, we don't anticipate any further conference calls or anything for the committee. So we just want to say thank you very much for all your time. You've put in an enormous amount of time and effort on this project, and I will be in touch by email. But at this point, pretty much all of your work is done on this project. So thank you.
And on behalf of Chris and I, thank you as well for your great preparation and participation, especially today as well. Have a good one.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for your time, and have a good evening.
Thanks.
And at this time, the call is concluded.